Palestinian national poet, Mahmoud Darwish. It's called "The Earth is Closing in on Us." The earth is closing in on us, pushing us through the last passage. Where should we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky? Mahmoud Darwish was a great poet who died a few years ago, and this is one of his most important poems. Let's talk a little bit about Hamas. In 2006, there was an election, which you write in your book, resulted in a resounding upset for Hamas. They won 74 out of 132 seats. You noted international monitors certified the election as free and transparent, while voters viewed Hamas as relatively incorrupt. But they viewed Fatah, that is PLO, as Israel's subcontractor in occupied territory. So talk about Hamas and how it's, in a way, a product of the conflict, the occupation.
Yes.
It may surprise some to learn that Israel supported Hamas in its early days.
Well, Israel helped create Hamas. During the first Intifada in 1987, Israel collaborated with the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt to create Hamas because they wanted a religious alternative to Fatah. Israel was threatened by the nonviolent civil disobedience of the First Intifada. In the first year of the First Intifada, the Palestinians demonstrated, they passed out leaflets. It was a nonviolent movement. Israel, however, locked up or deported all the leaders of nonviolence. And during that first year, Israel killed over 200 Palestinians. They imprisoned thousands. Yitzhak Rabin, who was the chief of staff at the time, ordered his soldiers to break the bones of Palestinian demonstrators. Well, according to B'Tselem, during the first year of the First Intifada, six Israelis were killed. According to Al-Haq, Law on the Service of Man, no Israelis were killed. Nonetheless, it was a nonviolent movement in the first year. So when Israel helped create Hamas, not only did they arm Hamas, give them weapons, but they allowed Sheikh Yassin, who is the spiritual leader of Hamas, to hand out anti-Semitic hate literature calling for the overthrow of Israel. They allowed that because they didn't want to be, they wanted to make sure the world didn't see them as brutally putting down a nonviolent movement. So they wanted to incite violence and demonize Hamas. And by the way, most of the leaders of Hamas were also jailed during the First Intifada. So that was the time when Hamas came out with its infamous charter that they wanted to obliterate Israel. Now, of course, Israel has always wanted to obliterate the Palestinian people. Noam Chomsky talked about this, how that clause in the Hamas charter, which I hear repeated all the time, oh, well, the Hamas wants to exterminate all the Jewish people. According to Noam Chomsky and others, that clause was inserted into the Hamas charter while most of the Hamas leaders were in prison by a very reactionary Hamas member who is now dead and who was not accepted really by Hamas as a mainstream member. But Hamas is a resistant movement. Yes, Hamas has done horrible things, just as the IRA, the ANC, the National Liberation Front of Algeria, the Tamil Tigers, they've all been resistance movements that have terrorized populations, unfortunately, I think it's unfortunate, in order to advance their cause. The Irgun and Stern Gang in Haganah were some of the most vicious terrorist gangs. But the one thing that was different between those three Jewish organizations and the aforementioned Hamas and the other aforementioned resistance movements is that those resistance movements, Hamas and the IRA, etc., they were the indigenous people trying to expel invaders. The Irgun Haganah and Stern Gang were the invaders trying to expel the indigenous people. So their claim is not, in my opinion, does not have as much historical momentum behind it. I want to mention the leader of the revisionist movement out of which the Irgun sprung was Vladimir Jabotinsky. And Jabotinsky, who died in the 1930s and was succeeded by Menachem Begin, Jabotinsky was a huge fan of Benito Mussolini. And he would send his Irgun recruits to Italy to train with the black shirts. David Ben-Gurion, so Jabotinsky was the head of the revisionist movement, and Ben-Gurion was the head of the socialist or labor movement. And they were, at the time, they were the two most prominent leaders of the Jewish community in Palestine. David Ben-Gurion used to refer to Vladimir Jabotinsky as Adolf Jabotinsky. And I have to say that if you read a lot of the correspondence or the discussions in the late 1940s, early 50s between amongst the Israeli leaders, they're often calling each other Nazis, and they're saying things like, "Well, we cannot talk about what some of our soldiers are doing because we'd have to mention the names of those we cannot mention," you know, stuff like that. So they were very well aware that what they were doing was very similar to what the Nazis had done to them. But then over time, all of this becomes more embedded. The rationalizations become more spread out, such as, you know, the Palestinians are Nazis that want to kill us all, and then you get more and more radical leaders until you have someone like Benjamin Netanyahu. His whole life has been dedicated to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. For years, he has been screaming that Iran is on the verge of getting a nuclear weapon for 30 years, and he has been constantly referring for years to the Palestinians as Amalekites. That is code for God told Moses, Joshua, Saul to kill every last Amalekite, including their livestock. So the religious Jews know what he's talking about. At least the religious Jews know what he's talking about. And the religious Jews are the main part of his coalition.
And Netanyahu's father was a close associate of Jabotinsky.
He was one of Jabotinsky's secretaries. And Netanyahu's father has said that my son agrees to the kinds of proposals and conditions that he knows the Palestinian, the Arab world could not possibly accept, such as we have one of Netanyahu's conditions would be the Jews must take control over all of Jerusalem. Well, the Arab world would never accept that, you know, and there's other things. But Netanyahu definitely has never, ever, the thought has never crossed his mind of making peace with the Palestinians. One time in 2009, obviously to pacify Barack Obama, he gave a speech at Bar Ilan University in which he mentioned that, you know, there would be peace with the Palestinians. But he didn't mean it, and everybody knew he didn't mean it, but except the stupid American suckers who believe everything Israel tells them.
You mentioned B'Tselem, that's the Israeli human rights organization.
Right.
The Israeli push to displace the Palestinians is not a new story, obviously. In 1937, the aforementioned David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, said, I'm quoting, "We must expel the Arabs and take their places, and if we have to use force, then we have force at our disposal," unquote.
In 1907, Ben-Gurion talked about starving the Palestinians so they'd have to leave. And Ben-Gurion talked about terrorizing the Galilee and ethnically cleansing and killing all the people in the Galilee. And Ben-Gurion was a moderate.
You said 1947?
In 48, I think it was, when he was talking about the Galilee. In 1907, he was talking about starving the Palestinians. Levi Eshkol, who was the third Israeli prime minister, another Labor Party prime minister, Labor Party being more to the left than what we have now, and Eshkol was the prime minister during the 1967 Six-Day War. Levi Eshkol talked about starving Palestinians and forcing them to leave. Ethnic cleansing, or as David Ben-Gurion would call it, compulsory transfer, was always compulsory. It's just that they knew they had to take their time. They had to take their time because, number one, they had to make sure they maintained the support of the United States, the greatest power in the world. And number two, they had to do it gradually because they didn't want to shock their gullible Jewish supporters in the United States into thinking that maybe I'm supporting the wrong side here. Maybe these people have gone crazy and have become what they have meditated on. They've meditated on Nazi atrocities and persecutors all throughout their history, and now they're becoming what they've meditated on.
Bipartisan support in Congress will no longer rock solid 100%. still lauds and praises Netanyahu, who, by the way, is the target, as you mentioned, of an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court. In June, in his address to Congress, he received more than 50 standing ovations. The U.S. seems to be central in this triangle between Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. It's U.S. policy that's enabling what's going on in terms of the occupation and the huge expansion of settlements, of,
right.
of colonies. I mean, talk about those things, but also about the kind of psychic numbing. I mean, I don't have to tell you, it is really difficult to watch the images on Al Jazeera.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Of the kids, you know, being maimed and the mothers crying and screaming. It's just unbearable. And so a kind of psychic numbing takes place. And I know people who say they don't watch the news.
Right.
They can't take it. It's too much pain.
Yeah.
What do you say to them?
I understand it. It's this has been going on and on and on. And I do think that part of the strategy is, Israel's strategy is that over time, people will start to forget. And then things will become more normal. But I do want to mention that without, Israel even admitted it, without U.S. military support from the Biden administration, Israel would not have been able to maintain their slaughter of Gaza for more than a few months. So the Biden administration is complicit in genocide. The Biden administration could have said, look, this is a horrible thing. We will help what happened on October 7th. We will help you hunt down the specific perpetrators, but it's time to make peace. But why didn't Biden say, well, he's afraid of the Israel lobby, but had he said it's time to make peace, we're not going to give you any arms. We're going to help you make peace, and we're going to support you. And they could have made peace according to the guidelines of the Arab Peace Initiative, which gives Israel a veto over any Arab Palestinian right of return and is flexible. It's an extraordinarily fair peace proposal, but Israel doesn't want peace.
When Israeli officials are asked why there are so many dead and wounded in Gaza and increasingly in the West Bank, they say it's Hamas's fault. They're using Palestinians as human shields. Respond to that trope, because it's widespread in all the media. It's almost an automatic. You know, they're using human shields.
Right. They've been saying that for years, and it has been refuted for years. In Israel, they have a term called the mosquito protocol. The mosquito protocol is when you detain a Palestinian. And normally, if you detain a Palestinian, you're going to throw him in jail, right? But the mosquito protocol is you detain a Palestinian and use him or her as a human shield. Now, I want to read you a couple of statements from a few of these human rights organizations about the use of human shields. From B'Tselem, since the beginning of the occupation in 1967, Israeli security forces have repeatedly used Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza as human shields, ordering them to perform tasks that risk their lives. Civilians could not refuse the demands placed on them by armed soldiers. End of quote. Human Rights Watch said, the Israel Defense Forces routinely coerce civilians to perform life-endangering acts such as knock on doors, open strange packages, and search houses where the IDF suspected armed Palestinians were present. End of quote. In 2013, the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child expressed, quote, deep concern about the continuous use of Palestinian children as human shields. I've read about little kids, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old little kids being forced by Israeli soldiers to go into the middle of the road and pick up a suspicious package that could be a bomb, or to knock on a door where they think there's Hamas soldiers. They've used pregnant women, and sometimes after they're done using these shields, they'll kill them. I recently read about an old man they used, and they killed him. During Operation Cast Lead in 2008-2009, Israeli soldiers would commandeer houses of Palestinians and set up sandbags as protection for themselves, with no protection whatsoever for the families that were still in the houses. The Goldstone Report, which was from the United Nations Human Rights Council, Judge Goldstone was a Zionist and a highly respected South African jurist who had ruled on the genocide in Rwanda and other things, and he headed a commission that investigated what happened during Cast Lead. And he said that both sides were probably guilty of crimes against humanity, but in particular the Israeli side. And the Goldstone report on Operation Cast Lead, quote, found no evidence that Palestinian armed groups used civilians as human shields, that they forced people to stay in areas under attack, that hospitals were used as shelters for Palestinian combatants, or that ambulances transported armed men. And I want to mention something. Before I ever studied the subject at all, this is prior to 2006, when people would say to me, well, Israel has killed children. Israel kills children. I would say, no, they don't. The only reason the children are killed by bullets that come from Israeli rifles is because the Palestinians, like Hamas and the other gangs, embed themselves in civilian population and use the civilians, including children, as human shields. I never heard that. I made that up. That just made sense, right? That was part of my internal logic. It was a collective internal logic. As I said earlier, we look at the world through the prism of how we identify ourselves.
The situation in the occupied West Bank is moving toward annexation. I think that's pretty clear. The time of Oslo in 1993, there were 200,000 settlers in the West Bank. That figure is now tripled.
Yeah,
it's at least
more than tripled,
750,000. So, you know, gee, Mr. Fora, there you paint a really grim picture, and I'm just one guy. You know, what can I do about this situation?
You know, we can only stay attuned. We can speak to our neighbors, anyone we think might become interested, and maybe get them interested. I don't know if it does any good, but I sign petitions every day from JVP, from Defense for Children International, from U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. There's so many organizations that I'm involved with, and I try to spread the word. I don't know what else we can do. You know, Israel has so much power. I will add, in the last month, because I was once a member of AIPAC, I'm on their mailing list. So in the last month, AIPAC has been sending at least one email every day, sometimes three a day. And those emails, most of them, include, in addition to expressing Israel's point of view and how Hamas is violating the ceasefire and Israel's only defending itself, in addition, it always asks their people to write to your congressman, write to your congressman. And I read an article recently that said that Congress people receive 10 times more emails from pro-Israel group people than they get from people who support the Palestinian side. But, you know, this is a serious problem. All we can do is we have to give it our attention. I know it's very hard to look at what is going on. Sometimes I can't bear it. I can't read everything that comes to me every day. But we have to stay attuned to it. We have to give it our attention. And, you know, maybe make relationships with Palestinians. That's all I can say. Join demonstrations. Whatever you think will help get the word out, whatever you think will add to the collective conscience of this country, do what you think can help with that. And that's the best we can do. We're living in the Kali Yuga, as the Hindus would say.
Why have Palestinians been unable to achieve statehood?
Mainly because of the United States. Because the United States enables Israel to ignore international law and to reject every single peace agreement. This is not an exaggeration. They've been unable because the power of the Jewish lobby and the power of narrative. So the Jewish narrative has been prominent in the United States for more than 75 years. What is the Arab narrative? The Arabs have always been demeaned, pretty much. In my opinion, Israel controls Middle East policy in the United States.
Look into your crystal ball now and tell us what you think is up ahead.
I think things are going to get darker. As long as Trump is president, things are bound to get darker. I don't even know if he's going to comply with judicial rulings that go against him. They may just thumb their nose at all of these and see what the Supreme Court says. And even if the Supreme Court doesn't go along with Trump, he wants to be a dictator. But Trump is in the pocket of Netanyahu, it seems. Now, I'm hoping that because of Trump's ego, he'll rebel because he can't be number two. although he's number two to Vladimir Putin also. But, I mean, right now, the Republican Party, which is dominated by Christian evangelicals, most of whom believe in the second coming of Christ, which requires that the Israelis ethnically cleanse the Palestinians, they really have incredible power right now. I don't see the Democrats getting it together to really be able to stop them, especially because most Democrats also are pretty strong supporters of Israel, even the Palestinian Chuck Schumer. So, so I can't really predict. I will say this. I do think that the unexamined mind, the mind that refuses to question its identity and its beliefs and images, I do think it is inherently self-destructive. And I don't see any reason why the world can't become darker and darker, you know, even though there will always be some light. But the momentum right now, judging by the election, I mean, Kamala Harris was no one to brag about, but look, we got Donald Trump. But judging by the election, what's happening in this country, what's happening in the Middle East, things are getting darker.
Well, the Canadian songwriter Leonard Cohen always says that there's always a little bit of light. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I'd like to thank you very much,
thank you.
Rich. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you, and have a very good evening. You were just listening to Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. I talked with him at the Boulder Public Library in late March. Richard Forer is the author of Wake Up, Essays on the Tragedy of Israel-Palestine, winner of the New York Big Book Award. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Maria Lopez Nunez, Gabor Mate, Shama Sawant, Tariq Ali, and Norman Finkelstein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine, and for his book, Wake Up, Essays on the Tragedy of Israel-Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the staff of the Boulder Public Library. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Oud Virtuoso, Marcel Khalife, performing Passport.
أنا الشجرة يعرفني. WRCT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to let you guys know that everything that you're going to hear today is strictly the opinions of myself and my guests today, and don't necessarily represent the views of WRCT. We're back. We're actually doing new episodes. I promise this is a thing. We're making it happen. And we have a guest today. We're actually talking about something interesting, or a couple interesting things today. We have a longtime friend of mine, hailing from Texas. We have Gavin here with us today. Welcome to The Angry Young Man.
Hello.
Yeah, so I mean, I had a couple things that would be interesting for us to talk about. I know there was something you wanted to talk about, but I've been reading what some may call the book of the year so far. I'm reading Abundance by Ezra Klein. You know, I've kind of
I have a copy of that.
You have a copy of that? I just now got a copy because they had, quite ironically, Abundance was not abundant for a period of time. I just got a copy of it. It's interesting because, you know, if for those of you who have listened to the show before, you'll know that I have a little bit of a fixation with housing. But it's interesting to see, you know, this argument for abundance liberalism and talking about using state capacity to kind of pursue growth and look at these things. I've only gotten about 30 pages into it so far. There's some things that I agree with. There's some things I disagree with. But I guess we'll start off this segment by kind of getting at that. I mean, Gavin, would you consider yourself an abundance liberal?
I'm not. I don't know. I guess I agree with the idea. I don't know.
I mean,
how would you define abundance liberal? And we'll go from there.
Well, I find it kind of the defining factor that separates it, the abundance liberal from, say, you know, the free market absolutist or fundamentalist, is the idea that there's a necessity to use state capacity to go after both supply and demand. I mean, they look at it as, and they open in the book by saying that, you know, for so long, because the fundamental kind of crux of economics is supply and demand, how it's been divided in half, and each side of the political spectrum has kind of made one of those their baby, in the sense that the right has been entirely supply focused and the left has been entirely demand focused. And, you know, the lack of understanding that both have their own importance, because they are supply and demand, not just supply or just demand. They kind of advocate for the, you know, the pushing of both to go about things. I mean, I have my fair share of disagreements kind of going out the gate with some of the claims, specifically as they relate to using state capacity to push for a lot of these things or to subsidize demand. Or to look for some of those things. They may be addressed later in the book. I haven't gotten just far into it just yet. But I mean, I'm curious, to what degree do you subscribe to those sorts of claims? And if so, what's your critique of say the market fundamentalist approach that I'm sure, you know, you're aware that I hold on this matter?
Yeah, I'd say, in all things, in housing, which is our first topic, in food and water, there we have, I guess, the title of the book, we already have a superabundance of all of these things. We have enough where if we had the perfect allocation of resources, a perfect system, nobody would ever starve. Because we have more food than anyone could eat. We have more housing. We have more homes than homeless people. All of these things. So we're at a point now where it's not really a matter of how do we grow food? How do we have more houses? How do we have enough for everyone to survive? Which is what most of human history was about. And we now are at a point of, okay, how do we think about our systems to have them structured in such a way that everyone has enough. And I think that's kind of where we should be going forward as a society at this point. So especially in terms of housing, I don't think we should accept homeless people as a concept at all. And if that means somebody has like a homeless shelter, that's like a little studio apartment, then that's what that is. I think you should be given the bare minimum. And I think beyond that, if you want to work for something harder, absolutely. Like even, and this is where I'm going to lose people, but like even if you're like a drug addict and you want to be in your home all day doing drugs, I don't think you should have a particularly good quality of life. I don't think, because you're not contributing to society at all. But I don't think it's very ethical to say somebody should die in that circumstance, just should be on the street and have no societal support. And it's not even like an ethical thing. Like homeless people are a drain on society as they exist. If they overdose, that's a drain on our medical system. If they live in like a northern climate, Pittsburgh, whatever, and it's the winter and they have pneumonia or frostbite or whatever. I don't know. I'm from Texas, so I don't know what happens when you get cold. It's a mystery. That's also a drain on the medical system. If they do a crime because they're so desperate and hungry and they have to go to prison, that's a drain on our prison system. So I think overall, you can even make an argument that just housing these people would be a cost-saving measure for society, for taxpayers overall. So that's sort of my position.
So, I mean, one of the kind of key things I want to zone in on, no pun intended, is... you know, you mentioned, you know, the crisis of homelessness, and something that they bring up very quickly in their section on at the outset is this idea of, you know, why do we have homelessness? Why does this happen? And mm-hmm. you know, they kind of zone in on the fact that more often than not, it's a cost issue, you know, in terms of how much the homes cost. And you know, in a lot of ways, I don't necessarily agree that we have enough housing or an abundance of housing. You know, at least in our metropolitan areas, there's not an abundance in the sense that we're able to address the massive demand in these areas. You'll look at states like California and New York that have been historically and notoriously bad at trying to address these issues with their zoning policies. I mean, you can drag in redlining if you really wanted to, but you know, it kind of falls down on this issue of there's this strand of liberal policy which has attempted to restrict supply, and as a result, has caused the crisis of homelessness, because all of these other things that we look at as a result. Where you have the drug epidemic as a result, or turning to violence. These are symptoms of the problem, not necessarily the problem in of themselves. So, I mean, at least coming from the my part of things, you know, you can address the cost issue at no cost by pulling back on a lot of these regulations that states like California and New York have been putting so much effort into holding up, and or at least have felt the pressure from the NIMBYs in their respective communities to uphold these regulations, which, quite frankly, it doesn't really cost anything materially outside of maybe the administrative cost of just kind of keeping the lights on while you're debating it. You know, for you to roll back these things, and you already experience so much change from there that, you know, it's an ambiguous amount of change. You know, how much are you going to make a dent in the homeless population? How much are housing prices going to fall down? But you could look at some pretty good case examples. You know, in your home state of Texas, I believe it was Austin that just recently saw rents tumble about 20% because the housing stock went up. You know, and that's it ultimately falls down to, you know, can you allow the market to address demand? I mean, if you're getting rid of these artificial caps, that should do enough in of itself. And then you kind of ask the question, well, is it necessary for us to start subsidizing demand again. On your front of things, it would appear that your position, to an extent, requires some amount of subsidizing demand, or doing some sort of subsidy to allow for access to housing. So I'm curious if that, you know, how that would play out, and to what degree the government or state capacity to act would be necessary if you were able to pull back on just the caps on supply.
Yeah, so just to re-clarify my position, like, obviously right now, there is a lot of cities where the housing situation is so far not great, not conducive to like universal housing. How do I put this? Like you were saying, like, rents are exorbitantly high in Los Angeles and New York. But I think my position is this is not like a human economic. Like, we have the labor capacity, we have the technology to build enough homes for everyone to live, just simply, just as simple as that. So then the question becomes, why don't we have that? I think you adequately addressed some of these issues. All of it is just policy issues, basically. Some of it might be like cultural or whatever, but I feel like the vast majority is policy. These are policy decisions that are very deliberately put in place. A lot of it is like the YIMBY NIMBY debate. I was going to bring up Austin myself because it's an example I'm well aware of. It's right in my neighborhood, so to speak. Austin has grown so much. You can look at a skyline picture of like Austin in 2015 versus Austin today, and it's like, it looks like a different city. And this isn't like because nobody wants, rents are also super low in Austin. And there's like two sides of that. There's supply and demand. And one might be tempted to say, well, nobody wants to live in Austin, but that's just not the case. You ask anybody.
Do you want to live in Austin?
I'd like to. Like, everyone wants to live in Austin. Austin's the cool place to live. It's like the LA of Texas. Like, people want to go there. So it's clearly not like a low demand thing. It's, they're doing something right. I think they've enacted good policies. Houston has done similar things. They have very, very notoriously soft zoning policies. So there's that, obviously. I think you would have to have a very strong state capacity if you wanted to like provide a universal layer of guaranteed homelessness. But I think it is possible. I think a really good example of this is Japan. Japan is a country of how, like, almost a billion people, right?
A good amount.
I don't know.
Not off the top of my head, but yeah,
maybe like, okay, 100 million. Okay, not nearly as much as I thought, but...
a lot of people, we'll put it that way.
They have, in their entire country, about 2,000 homeless people. And this is like in Tokyo. Like if there was a city the size of Tokyo in the US, there would be like a bajillion homeless people. So clearly like Japan is doing something right. And I think a big thing is that they have a pretty generous welfare system there. That kind of just doesn't accept homelessness is this thing. And I think a lot of it in Japan is also a cultural thing. Like this culture of there's a very, very strong stigma around homelessness and also like around hospitality. But I think a lot of it is like statewide decisions on the part of a government to support like very strong housing policies, because Tokyo is another place that has notoriously very low rents for a city of its size.
Well, I think you can look
Tokyo also has very, very you know, not great houses, but like these tiny, tiny little condos that people have.
Yeah, and that's
I think
kind of...
that's fine. That's great. That beats living on the street. So that's the kind of things that I would want. I would want like not a great quality of housing, because obviously like cost is a worry, but like anything's better than people living on the streets. So if there's a way to do this with like it being entirely free market, I would like that. But so far I haven't seen a good case of this being done like entirely through market forces and market incentives. So just to go back to your question, yeah, I think you would have to have a pretty strong government program for this to work.
I guess the one thing, and I will kind of pivot from there, is, in the case of Japan, they have extreme, especially Tokyo, extreme density, which allows, you know, is a supply thing. They have enormous supply.
Sure.
I mean, maybe it's not the best supply. You mentioned that, you know, they're not the best apartments, but it's supply nevertheless, which allows, you know, rents to go down like that. You know, there was a lot to consider, I guess, very briefly, because I know there's a bigger topic we want to get to. While we're on the topic of other nations, you know, immigration never ceases to be a topic of interest. I know we have very many overlapping positions on this, but I guess the thing I wanted to probe you on a little bit was, as it relates to the illegal nature of crossings, you know, be it for someone who's you know, either of ill intent or not. I guess, you know, because we definitely agree, you know, there needs to be reform in the system as it relates to making it easier to immigrate. But as it relates to people who do come illegally, if you do go about treating it as a criminal offense, being that it you know, it is a crossing that is not legal. So I'm curious to probe your thoughts on that, especially being from a border state. Kind of very briefly what you think.
I have to organize my thoughts for a second. Sorry. I feel like when we call it like this illegal, like it moralizes it a lot that they've done some big crime. And I just don't see illegal things as necessarily morally bad things. You know, you can imagine a situation like a mother stealing food for a starving kid. I don't see that as morally bad. And a lot of the times, this illegal immigration is a similar thing. It's these people in very, very desperate situations, so desperate that like I can't even imagine having to make some of these decisions. I know in the case of a very famous case recently of I'm not sure exactly what his name is. I think it's Kilmar Abrego Garcia.
Yes, the Venezuelan gentleman.
El Salvadorian.
Oh, sorry. We're jumping between El Salvador and Venezuela so much right now in the news that get the streams crossed. But yes.
He was coming to the United States because a gang back in El Salvador was threatening the life of him and his family. And he came here and he worked in the United States. He has a pretty good paying job. He's contributing to the economy. He's paying taxes. He's buying local goods. He has a family. He has a wife who's an American citizen. He has a kids here. And even though, yes, he came here illegally originally, I'm not comfortable saying he's any less American than you and me. And so it's sort of a case by case basis like that. If they're coming here to do terrible things, then obviously I'm not happy with that. If they're here to do crimes, if they're here to smuggle drugs, that's not great. But I don't think that's the vast majority of the people who are being deported right now. So I think you'd have to deal with that on a case by case basis, decide, is this person well integrated in the American society and the American economy? Are they contributing to our economy? And did they come here under a situation of distress? I think those are all considerations you have to make in these cases. And I think more often than not, I would like these people to stay here because it is a good thing for immigrants to be here. And it's very difficult for them to come here right now.
Yeah. And I think that's the crux of where we have a lot of our agreement that, you know, I think we both agree it should be easier to come here. You know, I definitely hold the sentiment that it is a good thing to have immigrants in this country. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for the fact that my grandparents came here as recently as the 1960s. So, you know, I definitely have.
Neither of us are Native Americans. I don't think most of the people listening are 100% Native Americans. So we're all immigrants.
And I think, you know, kind of where the thing I wanted to kind of zero in on is, you know, you bring up the point of, say, you know, a mother who steals bread. You know, we show compassion in those cases where we review the violation of the law. I'm curious to what extent do we provide, say, slaps on the wrist, because mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're still talking about irrespective of the fact that, you know, potentially there's a moral good or even maybe a moral ambiguity. You know, there is a law that's broken, and I think that's, you know, the key core and principle thing here. To what extent do you exercise grace, and to what extent do you go about the upholding of the law? So I mean, you know, there it's a lot to kind of touch on, but unfortunately we cap ourselves to 30 minutes here, and you know, restrain the you know, free flow of intellectual debate. But I know, you know, there was the one thing that you wanted to get to, and I definitely want to make sure we had some time to speak about it. You wanted to speak about gender. I would assume this is of a broad sort of heady general what do we think here? But I'm is there something specifically that you wanted to touch on?
So this is for a class project of mine, obviously. So I wanted to get your opinion on this. So there's this sort of model of three different models of marriage. So there's this idea of a traditional marriage. This is what you imagine, like the housewife. You know, the wife typically doesn't work. If she does, it's like maybe a part-time job. She does the majority of the housework, the majority of taking care of kids. And then there is this neo-traditional model. Let's hold that thought. Let's go to the opposite end. There's this progressive model where this is what like a very egalitarian person would advocate all marriage should look like. You know, equal, both the mother and the father are breadwinners. You know, they might have roughly equal incomes, and they split housework, they split caring for the kids equally amongst them. And then there's this neo-traditional model, which is a bit of a mix of the two. Of this, basically the mother does work, but she also does the brunt of the housework, of the taking care of the kids. And I wonder, of those three models of marriage, which of those would sound the most appealing to you? Which of those you believe, not our society should be structured on, but which do you believe you would want your ideal marriage to look like?
Oh, this is interesting. We're breaking from the politics here on the show, which is cool, I guess.
Let's say scaling it down to a microscopic level.
I guess we can say that. I mean, listen, I'm in many ways I'm an old school guy. You know, that's just the kind of world I grew up in. More often than not, the type of people of my background gravitate towards the neo-traditional in a lot of ways. Because I think this is also informed in a lot of ways by my faith. I definitely think, you know, as a Catholic, you know, there's this in conception of marriage, we define, you know, separate but equally important roles for both the man and the woman in the relationship. And I think, you know, this is kind of the thing that's lost on a lot of people when they look at the Catholic or, you know, even generally Christian conceptions of of marriage between a man and a woman, because it's, you know, obviously there are certain things that both the man and the woman have going on for their respective roles in the marriage, but they are of equal importance, and there's equal accountability between both halves to hold up their end of the bargain. I don't think that the neo-traditional model really deviates much from that, from the traditional, in so much as it still maintains kind of the core essence of what's going on, with some, you know, realities that kind of reflect back on potentially some of the socioeconomic factors we have to kind of put into consideration for a lot of families that are currently trying to make ends meet and need to live on two incomes. I mean, I can tell you it's definitely not easy in New York to afford to live there, when the median households the median house price selling in my home county is almost $750,000. It's ludicrous. So, you know, I can say that I would kind of bounce between the two. But, you know, obviously, as a libertarian, so long as you're not hurting other people, I'm very much of the opinion that you, you know, pursue the model that works for you. But I'm curious then, you know, is there any kind of further consideration from that you wanted to touch on? Or, where you personally kind of fall on that? Where does that kind of pan out for you?
So for me personally, obviously, I'm a very progressive person, so I think that's the type of model I would want. Sort of shared responsibility, both parents having relatively equal static income levels. And this is sort of the environment I was raised in. My parents, sometimes some would lean a little bit more, but generally I feel like both my mom and my dad had a very big role in raising me. So I'm curious, you said that in your faith, both the men and the women have these separate but equally important roles. So I'm curious, what would you conceive as the role for the man in a marriage?
I mean, he's ultimately the primary provider, you know, and mm-hmm. this kind of falls back into, you know, sure, there can be, you know,
so like kind of this breadwinner role.
Yeah, and you know, at the same time, you know, the woman, you know, can, and if she has the desire to do so, should pursue, a source of income as well. But you know, the conception is, you know, that there's the primary role in the part of the man to do so, being kind of the ultimate defender of the family, things of that sort, you know, which is mirrored in a lot of ways by the nature of both men and women in just kind of how there's a kind of attitude of what manhood is and what womanhood is that's presented through the Bible, which mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't mean that it's kind of cut and dry, this is the case. I mean, you know, obviously we're not, you know, from the perspective of faith, we're all made in God's image, but we have varieties upon which that is different. But, you know, there's kind of broad generalizations that encompass certain deviations as well that just are brought forth by the Bible. And I did actually do a very interesting Bible study a while back on, you know, mm-hmm. what does the Bible say about manhood? What does it mean to be a man? What are the virtues inherent to masculinity? We're kind of in the last minute here. I mean, any kind of closing thoughts there that you wanted to bring in?
No, this has been really, really great. A good conversation, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if you feel the same way.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, it's always so crazy how fast the time goes. You know, it is.
Yeah, I was very surprised about that.
it makes you yearn for the days of ye old tavern. You know, the coffee, whatever you wanted, the salon. But anyways, thank you for coming on. It was a pleasure to have you, and I hope you guys enjoyed having, you know, an actual guest on the show once again. But I'll send you all off with this. You all have a wonderful rest of your day. Take care, and God bless.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we continue our coverage of the Israeli-U.S. genocidal assault against the people of Palestine.
Our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges, who joins us to update the situation in Gaza. His recent book is titled A Genocide Foretold, Reporting on Survival and Resistance in Occupied Palestine. We then take a look at the MAGA ideology with returning guest, Monthly Review editor John Bellamy Foster.
We'll discuss his recent Monthly Review article titled The MAGA Ideology and the Trump Regime.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The world looks on in horror as Israel continues its genocidal assault on the Palestinian people. According to Benjamin Netanyahu, and I quote, "The only inevitable outcome will be the wish of Gazans to emigrate outside of the Gaza Strip." He told this to his lawmakers at an elite closed-door meeting. And he continues, "But our main problem is finding countries to take them in." According to our guest today, Chris Hedges, the Israeli war in Gaza marks the end of a world where humanitarian law, conventions that protect civilians, really matter. In a recent piece, Hedges claims that the genocide in Gaza is part of a pattern. "It is the harbinger of genocides to come," he writes. "It puts to rest the lie of human progress, the myth that we are evolving morally. Only the tools change. Where once we clubbed victims to death or chopped them to pieces with broadswords, today we drop 2,000-pound bombs on refugee camps, spray families with bullets from militarized drones, or pulverize them with tank shells, heavy artillery, and missiles." So we've invited Chris Hedges to join us today to discuss the situation in Gaza and what he claims it portends for the future of relations between the peoples of this world. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, and the former Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. Among his books is A Genocide Foretold, Reporting on Survival and Resistance in Occupied Palestine. Well, Chris Hedges, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you very much.
Chris, in a recent writing of yours, you claimed that Gaza's present situation was foretold long ago. You also recently interviewed Amy Kaplan, author of Our American Israel, The Story of Entangled Alliance. So talk to us about this notion, your contention, really, that Gaza's history was long ago foretold.
Well, you know, I spent 7 years in the Middle East and much of that time in Gaza, covering the Israel-Palestine conflict. And the antecedents of the current genocide have long been part of Israel's essentially DNA. In 1948, a series of massacres and the displacement of roughly 750,000 Palestinians. And then in the 1967 war, another 350,000 Palestinians were displaced. But in between those conflicts and after that, there was a kind of slow-motion ethnic cleansing, which I covered. With the rise of Netanyahu, his father was a member of the Herut Party. The Herut Party came out of the Zionist terrorist groups, the Irgun and others, and always called for...
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved.